Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, and electronic dance music, and now heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Roll Cast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com. Today, Nate welcomes Lance Scott Walker to discuss Houston's DJ Screw. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and today we're joined by Lance Scott Walker to talk about his book, DJ Screw, A Life and Slow Revolution. Lance, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is very Texas, very close to our heart, very near and dear. DJ Screw, one of the Gen Xers from Texas who had the biggest impact on the musical world. But his career is a little different. Like, DJ Screw is fundamentally a remixer, really, rather than a producer. And his work was released on mixtapes that are technically bootlegs. Can you explain, like, just the basic who, what, when, where, and why of DJ Screw? How did he get his music to market? And what was he actually doing?
Right. So DJ Screw started in the mid-1980s in Smithville, Texas. He grew up in Houston when he was a kid, and then moved back to Smithville, which is where his family is from. And that was when the movie Break-In came out, and he got interested in hip-hop and DJing and started pursuing DJing, and then moved to Houston in 1986 and started to meet some people and started to get exposed to some new music and new styles. And over the course of the next 5 or 6 years, developed a style of slowing down records, and while he was making mixtapes, and taking two copies of a record on either turntable, playing one of them a little bit behind the other one, and then using his crossfader to chop back and forth between those records and repeat rhythms and repeat phrases, repeat words, anything that he was hearing that he kind of wanted to hear again. And eventually these tapes sort of evolved into freestyle sessions where local rappers or would-be rappers would come over to his house, and he'd run instrumentals, and they'd record freestyles. They'd just freestyle off the top of their head, whatever they were thinking. And he would record the sessions, and then he would take them and he would slow them down on a cassette and run off cassette tapes, copies of cassette tapes, and sell them out of his house. And that's the basic story of how his career got going. You know, he did a couple of market albums. You know, he did a couple of label albums through over the years, but for the most part, his bread and butter was the mixtapes that he recorded in his own house, which, you know, he eventually opened a store and eventually started actually printing up the tapes. But for the most part, during his career, the tapes were Maxell XL cassettes that he ran off at his house, and that reflected and also documented and created the culture of Houston, Texas.
And there were a couple of other DJs in the Houston area that had been selling remix tapes before this, but none of them were as big and established as Screw later became. So when he started selling mixtapes, it was kind of like people are really going to give me money for this. And his friends had to kind of talk him into, yeah, and you should charge this much. How much was he charging for a mixtape?
$10.
And so, you know, just for a tape that he had made on a Jambox at home. And it's interesting the way that this micro economy emerged in Houston, because it emerged in similar ways in other cities in the U.S. around the same time. Memphis, Atlanta, New York, LA, all had mixtape DJs that were doing the same thing. You also had the same thing sort of in the techno and house scenes, where DJs that were running raves and stuff start making tapes and started in Chicago kind of early on. So it's interesting to me that how organically this emerged. And the fact that he was so successful at this, that he's literally got sort of drug dealer problems where he has shoeboxes full of cash. He's got police scrutiny. He's got the IRS all down on his neck. But the record companies actually came to look at DJ Screw as a promotional vehicle rather than as somebody that was bootlegging. Can you explain what the record companies thought of what he was doing and how they accommodated a relationship with DJ Screw and other mixtape makers?
Well, it's a little bit of a gray area, but, you know, suffice to say that, you know, record companies could see, at least back then, you know, we had sound scan information that, you know, people were buying records at record stores and they would scan them. And so record companies had a pretty good lead on where records were being sold, which records were being sold. And Houston was a big market. So, you know, it's hard to argue with that. If you see that somebody has taken a market share away, or if there's a market share that has been taken away, it's kind of easy to maybe point the finger and say, well, that DJ Screw is putting our songs on his tapes, and so nobody's buying our records. But really, it was the opposite, because, you know, DJ Screw's tapes were the first place that a lot of people heard certain music, new music, you know, that might be the first place that they heard it was on DJ Screw's tapes. And that might be, and likely, and as was the case in many cases, the, you know, Screw's tapes led people to an artist. Okay, well, I first heard, you know, Ice Cube or Ice-T or whoever it was on one of DJ Screw's tapes, and now I want to go buy one of his albums. You know, I mean, I'm sure you saw that time and time again. So the record companies, I think at first didn't like the idea that, that, you know, Screw was making mixtapes that featured their songs on them, but, you know, with kind of the way that he was changing the music as he was recording it and creating something really new out of it, not just slapping people's songs on their tapes. And the fact that it served as an introduction, like I was saying, for a lot of people, and they could see that the market share wasn't hurt in Houston because it's such a big hip hop market. I think there was a certain point where the labels just kind of let it go. And in fact, some of them started sending him records like, no, by all means, send him your records. He'll put them on his tapes and then people will hear them.
And let's talk a little bit about Smithville and his origins. Like, people hear Smithville and they think country and this, you know, like what can these kids know about hip hop? How was he getting his information about hip hop? What were the radio stations? What were the music stores that were hipping him to what was going on in the bigger world?
No record stores in Smithville. There was a record store in LaGrange at one point. And of course, that Smithville is not too far from Austin. In Smithville in the early 1980s, you could pick up an independent left of the dial radio station out of Austin. The call letters of which are escaping me right now, but
I think it's KAZI.
It's
still there. Yeah.
It's KAZI. That's exactly it. You're right. And so he would listen to KAZI. They would be able to pick up something there. They could pick up on clear nights. They could pick up a radio station from Houston, which I always found surprising, but you know, the Houston, you know, has got big radio stations, they're big blowtorches, and so a lot of people can pick up that signal. Didn't have MTV. There wasn't any. Most of the local radio anywhere in the Hill Country was just mostly playing country or maybe blues. But Screw knew a couple of older guys that had records, and in fact, one who was a DJ, one who was a record collector and had a lot of equipment, but another one who was actually a DJ and who was actually going to Houston and buying records in Houston, which is of course where you could get great hip hop records because there was already a scene going on there. So the exposure didn't really so much come off of the radio in general, even though, you know, there's a couple shows that he could pick up here and there. Didn't have MTV or anything like that, but MTV in the early 1980s wasn't showing hip hop anyway. So it was really sort of a patchwork of, you know, places that he was getting hip hop records from. But I think maybe even more important was the fact that, you know, since DJing was his thing and he loved the mechanics of DJing. He loved the idea of being able to play records for people. He loved the idea of being able to kind of rethink how those records unrolled in time. You know, the fact was that the records that he had available to him were his mother's records, blues records, R&B records. And these are some of the first records that he really got his hands on, was really able to play over and over again and kind of get to know the grooves and how they worked and everything. And I think that's really important because, it, you know, later on, if you go and listen to a lot of his mixtapes and look at the freestyles, the sort of bed, the foundation, the beat that he used for a lot of tracks where people are freestyling are old R&B tracks. And I think that, that musical education comes from his mother. And I think that if he had had stacks and stacks of hip hop records to begin with, it would have been a sort of a different education. It wouldn't take anything away from him. But I'm just saying, I think that because of the fact that what he had available, which is his mother's records, it sort of gave him a musical education sort of from a different angle. And then by the time he was getting into Houston and there were more record shops all over the place, and he was able to get his hands on some hip hop, by then he really knew how to handle records and he kind of knew what he was listening for.
All right, let's hear our first song. This is Hardcore Life by Triple Threat. This is a track DJ Screw actually produced.
You best come equipped, a nine double limb, sort of gauge with that pistol grip. They say prevent violence, but what the fuck did them hoes know? Cause fool without a got you won't survive in the ghetto. Yup, this life that I live is far away from a fairy to never know heaven on earth because my hood's like a living hell. Niggas I hear, don't give a damn cause we bought none. So if you wanna go, come along, ho, and get you something. Full of them lunatics and niggas pull tricks quick. Fiends be fiending them, many hoes be like sucking dick. Cause money's the key, and yeah, I'm out for a profit. Cause this is my dope in my block, so ho, you can't stop it. We guess niggas need to stay home with your...
And that was Hardcore Life by Triple Threat. And so tell us, for the benefit of those who don't technically understand the difference, what's the difference between producing a track like he did for Triple Threat and what he normally did when he would remix tracks?
Well, when Screw was remixing tracks, he was just doing so with the records. That was his main tool that he was using, was the records that had already been produced. In some cases, he might have an instrumental, and in many cases, he would have an instrumental or the acapella with which to work. And he could layer those over different songs and kind of mash them up and really rethink the linear arrangements of the songs. So that's what he was doing when he was mixing. He was taking pre-existing tracks in a more or less finished form and rethinking them. But when he was producing, that was when he was actually using, musical instruments, drum machines and keyboards and of course the turntables, scratching is the turntables as a musical instrument. So there's your difference right there, is that he was actually creating music from out of nothing when he was producing, like as he did with Triple Threat, which is a very early project that he did, 1991, 1992 era. And before he was really known for his mixtapes is when that one came out. And so it's a different approach. It's a different with the mixtapes he's creating, but he's creating from something that's already been released. Whereas when he was producing, he was creating from scratch.
All right. I think that should satisfy the listeners. And there's a couple of people that he came across when he was pretty young in Houston that were DJs that themselves put out some slowed down tracks. And that's DJ Screw's big, that's what he's most famous for. When you see a CD in Houston to this day that says it's screwed and chopped, that means it's slowed down and mixed up. But tell us a little bit about Daryl Scott and Steve Fournier and what they were doing, how they helped kickstart the hip hop scene in Houston and how they influenced DJ Screw and his taste for slowing down tracks.
Well, I think out of the two, Daryl Scott would be the one who more so influenced DJ Screw. I don't believe that Screw and Fournier knew each other or really overlapped in their orbits. It was kind of a different scene. Steve Fournier was very important to the Houston scene, I should say. They're kind of from different eras. Although I do believe that Screw may have subscribed to Steve Fournier's record pool. I might be wrong on that. But anyway, so Steve Fournier was a club DJ and a promoter who was really the pioneer of a club called the Rhinestone Wrangler, which is where all the early Houston rappers were freestyling and, competing against one another in battle rap contests in a club setting. And a lot of that was going on in the neighborhoods and in the schools and in the streets. But, that was the first place in Houston where there was a club where people could go to and actually freestyle and battle rap against one another. But Daryl Scott was a much more profound influence on DJ Screw, because Daryl Scott was a mixtape DJ and a live DJ, a club DJ, who got his start in the mid late 1970s in clubs as a really young man, like, you know, just barely a teenager, was in the clubs. And then in the early 1980s, and he was playing funk and R&B and kind of party and some disco and that sort of thing, proto hip hop really. And then in the early 1980s, as hip hop records start coming out, Daryl Scott starts, you know, seamlessly, you know, folding those into what he was doing. And Steve Fournier also in that same era, I got to say, was one who was bringing hip hop records to the clubs. And in a lot of cases, clubs where they didn't really want to hear hip hop, or the club owners didn't want to hear hip hop anyway, but he fought to get it in there. But Daryl Scott was making mixtapes and going to a, you know, big park in Houston on the South Side where everybody sort of congregates on Sundays. And he couldn't run off enough cassettes. He'd sell out of anything he brought with him because everybody loved his mixtapes. His were the hottest in town because he was a great track selector and he was a great mixer. And, and people just loved what it was that he did. He was an icon for a lot of people. He was a hero for a lot of people. And there was no better example of that than, you know, in late 1984, when, he opened his own record store in Houston, Blast Records and Tapes. And, you know, so this is a young black man opening his own business that's music oriented, music based, after he had, you know, already built up goodwill and showed his hard work within the community. So it was really inspiring for a lot of people, when Daryl Scott opened that record store, Blast Records and Tapes. And then in the following years, he kept releasing tapes. He sold his mixtapes out of his record store along with other, you know, official releases that were coming out. And some of his mixtapes in the late 1980s, he slowed down some songs, and he was doing what he was calling doubling, which is the same kind of idea of what Screw was doing with chopping. He was doing that on some of his cassettes, not together and not wholesale. It wasn't really his whole thing by any stretch. It was really just something he sort of did, in a few different spots. But it was a big influence on Screw, because Screw idolized Daryl Scott, because everybody in Houston idolized Daryl Scott. So when those two met in the late 1980s, early 1990s, you know, it was a big deal for Screw, because he had somebody who he could really talk to about technique and learn from. And, Daryl Scott was really a generation older than Screw, and was on his way to, you know, he was already mentoring young people in the neighborhood and was on his way to the ministry and, really, really, you know, looking out for the younger generation and wanting to inspire them. And it worked very much so in the case of DJ Screw, because, he started taking some of those techniques that he had heard from Daryl Scott and running off in another direction with them, really very much inspired. And also alongside another young DJ in Houston named Michael Price, who, you know, was tragically murdered in 1993, but nevertheless was a big part of Screw's, you know, burgeoning enthusiasm for slowing music down and really kind of chewing on it and getting to really understand what music was about. You know, they came from different angles on that, but they were very much both inspired by and mentored by Daryl Scott. So Daryl Scott remains an incredibly important figure in Houston to this day. He's he retired for a long time, but in this last year, he's come out of retirement and done a couple of slowed and chopped mixes for a couple of local artists. So it's really interesting to see that come all the way back around.
Yeah, that's great. And let's hear our next track. This is DJ Screw, Pimp the Pen, featuring Lil Kiki.
I'm draped up and dripped out, know what I'm talking about. 3 in the morning, getting a get out the stash pot. Fire up a fat sweet, turning on the bulb lights. Hand on the wool grain, ass on the tight white. Showing naked ass in the great state of Texas. Home of the player, so it never be no plexus. So long we've been waiting. Never ever hating. In Houston we elbows, in Cali they dating. So 1996, you hoes better duck, because the world gon' drip candy and be all screwed up. Just pop in your...
And that was Pimp the Pen from DJ Screw featuring Lil Kiki. And so How did DJ Screw establish himself once he came down to Houston? I mean, obviously, a lot of kids wanted to be DJs. He didn't have the best equipment or anything. How did he get established as a DJ and get in a position where people would want to buy his mixtapes?
He met the right people. And one of the ways that he met the right people was he moved into the right apartment complex with his father. And, in 1989, somewhere in there, he and his father moved to the Quail Meadows apartment complex on Telephone Road in Houston. And there were a lot of people in that complex. There were hundreds of units and, you know, probably thousands of people living in that complex. It's a huge complex. It stretched several blocks down Telephone Road. And it was a place where a lot of people went to buy drugs. So there was a lot of traffic coming in and out of there. And Screw was, you know, had been working on his craft really for years by then. And he would work on his craft there in the apartment. The difference is, at this point now, what he was doing was something that people could kind of walk by his apartment and hear that there was something going on in there. Whereas, you know, prior to that, he lived in a neighborhood that wasn't far away. But he lived in a neighborhood, you know, many streets over, where there would have been no foot traffic coming by to hear what he was doing. So as Screw spent more and more time in the new apartment complex where they'd moved, he got to meet more and more people. People got turned on to what he was doing. And it was one of his neighbors there who became one of his friends who was the first one to say, "Hey, I'd like to buy one of those mixtapes that you're making." And that's what started that part of it. So really it was a very organic process where, you know, local, not necessarily artists, but just local hip hop enthusiasts. Some of them who may have, you know, also been, dealing some crack cocaine or some weed and had lots of people who were coming to see them. Once Screw started selling those tapes, some of those drug dealers started actually promoting the tapes too. "Hey, while you're here, you should go over to, you know, DJ Screw's apartment and get yourself a tape made." So that was one of the ways that it started. Another way that it's, you know, that he really started getting his work out there was because of his relationship with another DJ, Andrew Hatton, DJ Chill, who he met at Sterling High School, and who at least by 1990, 1991 was getting Screw involved in a lot of DJ gigs. They both kind of had half a set of equipment. And when they put their stuff together, they had one pretty good set of equipment. And DJ Chill was very adept at getting gigs. He was adept at getting gigs at parties or at schools or whatever it might be. And eventually at clubs. But he took Screw along with him. And as a matter of fact, DJ Chill, the kind of personality he is, he's a great DJ, but he's also a great host. And so when he took Screw with him, he'd just let Screw DJ all night, and he'd just take the microphone, he'd just MC and kind of organize the parties. But so, you know, there were a couple different wheels turning in the early 1990s that got Screw's tapes out there, for one, by the traffic that was coming through the Quail Meadows apartment complex, and that really helped to promote his tapes all along around the South Side. But the other part of it was in working with DJ Chill, because it got Screw out into the clubs, and it turned Screw into a professional DJ is what it did. You know, at a point long before he was actually going to sort of, you know, people talk about DJ Screw being a hermit. I mean, there's some truth to that, not completely, because he did get out and play gigs, but suffice to say that in the early years, he got out and played a lot of gigs, and it made him very organized and it got him to a point where he knew his equipment very well. And it also really kind of upped his game as it went with working with the people around him, you know, working with the sound people in the clubs, or the promoters in the clubs, or the club owners, that sort of thing. And also, you know, playing to an audience, because that was a new thing for DJ Screw. So there's really a lot of wheels that were turning in those early years that were really super important in shaping how he was going to move forward.
And there's two terms that I'd like you to get explained to the audience that are very important for Houston hip hop in this period. And I'm talking about slabs and I'm talking about lean. What are slabs and what is lean? And how did this create this car hip hop culture that blossomed and created, you know, made DJ Screw such a big thing in Houston?
Well, both of them have roots that go way back, way, way before DJ Screw. You know, people were customizing cars in Houston, you know, from as far back as you can, as far back as you can dream. But I would say that as hip hop culture came alive in around the world, as it were, in the mid 80s, you know, 1984, 85 is when we're seeing hip hop movies come out. And that's really what awakened a lot of people to what was going on and with the new genre. And, you know, people outside of New York, you know, got to hear what was going on and, you know, really got a taste of all that. So, the slab is, the idea behind the slab is that it's an old car. Usually a lot of cases, sort of a long body car. It could be any kind of car, but, sort of long body Cadillacs and, you know, older models from the 70s that had maybe kind of seen better days, but the body, the foundation of the car, the foundation, there you go, that's the slab. That's the relationship between the term right there. The slab, as in like, okay, I'm going to take this slab and build it up from there. So the slab, as it were, is like basically a car that, you know, had, like I said, has seen better days, but is very functional and can be customized and built kind of from the ground up. So what does that mean? That means, you know, body work. That means a new coat of paint. And specifically in Houston, what's called candy paint, which is paint with a metallic flakes mixed into it so that it looks wet. So it shines in a way that regular car paint doesn't. It's more expensive and it's, you know, it's a lot more difficult to apply correctly. You know, there are people in Houston who specialize in it. Ike over in on the East End in particular. You'll hear his name pop up in lyrics. You know, got my car sprayed by Ike, which is in Wanna Be a Baller. So the slab, and it's not just the paint. You know, there's the rims, there's the spoke rims that go on there. There's the custom, you know, headrests and television sets put into cars now. That probably not so much the case in the 80s and early 90s. But you know, all the insides done in custom leather and custom colored leather. So it's really a matter of taking an old car and bringing it, not just bringing it back, but bringing it into an innovative approach to thinking about how you want to present that car. And sometimes there'll be a pop, you know, trunk that will pop up and some neon inside of there and a fifth wheel on that trunk. There's all, you know, everybody kind of has their own style. So that style was already happening in the early 80s and mid 80s. And I think, you know, like I said, there were customizers around town who really specialized in bringing people's sort of dreams to fruition as it preferred to their vehicles. So that continued to grow over the years. Lean is codeine promethazine, a recreational codeine promethazine, which, you know, maybe not necessarily in the form of codeine promethazine, but had been recreationally, cough syrup had been recreationally consumed in Houston for decades leading up to that. People were drinking it with beer or wine coolers. And, you know, I'd say late 80s, early 90s is when kind of, you know, our generation, Generation X, started drinking it with soda water and ice. And, you know, I think people started throwing Jolly Ranchers in there at some point. So these are two things that, you know, that were talked about on Screw's tapes as people were freestyling. These are things that they talked about, but they were things that were in place already. There were things that were happening in Houston, and Screw's tapes just made those things that much more popular. Why they called codeine promethazine lean is because when you drink it, it's sort of a, you know, it's definitely an intoxicating effect, and it's you know, people say it kind of makes you lean over, kind of slows time down for you and everything. And so people make that connotation, people make that connection to Screw's music through lean, because they say, well, if you're on lean and you listen to Screw's music, then you'll totally get it. Of course, there's truth to that, but you don't have to take drugs to enjoy DJ Screw's music. It's right there, you know, right there in the music.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. When we come back, I want to ask you about the screwed up click and the rappers that Screw assembled around him to freestyle on his tapes. And so when Screw first started making mixtapes, he would have basically just the song, sometimes slowed down, chopped a little bit. And then he started adding shout outs, and he would let people pay a little extra, and they could get a shout out to their hood, pay even a little more extra, and they could personally shout out. How did that evolve into rappers like Fat Pat and Big Hawk and Lil Kiki and ESG and others freestyling on the Screw Tapes? How did this crew come together, and who was the first, and who were some of the most important rappers he worked with?
Well, you're right that there were little flashes of that over the years, the shout outs. And, you know, of course, he was building up his techniques over the years. But really, when we get to the most important pivot point, really, is at the end of 1993, beginning of 1994, when Screw moved out of the apartment that he shared with his father, which, you know, in which he was really beholden to his father's schedule, his father's rules, his father's moods, you know, do you know, can you come over? Can people come over? Can you come buy a tape? Can you come in? Can you get on the microphone? You know, all that was very limited when he lived with his father. But at the end of 1993, he and his girlfriend Nikki moved into a house in a neighborhood called Golf Crest on the sort of the east end of the South Side. And that's where things really changed, because there were people that he knew. He knew Fat Pat, you know, he knew ESG, you know, there were people that he knew in the scene. He knew C-Note from the Botany Boys. You know, there's plenty of people that he knew, but once he got his own house and he had no rules as to when people could come over there, that's when the freestyle started happening. That's when he was able to start really letting the music roll and letting people take that microphone and letting that magic sort of naturally come out. I don't know if that was necessarily planned or if it was more so just that the personalities that were coming out on the tapes sort of cleared that room for themselves. The first one to really freestyle on a tape, there are plenty of people who did shout outs over the year, but you know, when we go back through the history, the first one noted to have freestyled on the tape was the rapper C-Note from the group Botany Boys. And once Fat Pat, who was a neighborhood superstar and a neighborhood you know, icon, really, because he was such a gigantic personality and he was so funny. And he, you know, he was really the most kind of, before he was really even an artist, he was the most complete artist of any of them. He was just a ready-made rock star. He was a gigantic dude. He was really loud and really confident. He saw everybody in the room and really kind of took everybody in and kind of sucked all the attention out of every room. So, really, you know, once Screw had Fat Pat over to the house, and once Fat Pat heard that C-Note had freestyled on the tape, he couldn't get over there fast enough. And then once Fat Pat started freestyling on Screw Tapes, he really set the tone for what everybody else was going to end up doing. You know, he really kind of set the tone of like, this is what you can do on one of these tapes. This is the way that you can express yourself. Which in turn was also what Screw wanted. You know, Screw wanted to provide a platform for people. And all of this is kind of, you know, they're inventing all of this sort of on the fly. I mean, this isn't like some grand plan where they sat down and sketched it out, nor is it anything that they really had a template from which to work. You know, nobody had done this prior, but I think that the personalities and the openness of Screw and the way that Screw really wanted to see people shine and see people kind of come alive and express themselves, I think all of that just provided a perfect situation for these things to take off. So early on, you've got Fat Pat, you've got his brother Hawk, who came in a little bit later. He's the older brother, but he started rapping a little bit later. You've got ESG, who came over from Louisiana and was already rapping, freestyling in Louisiana, and really brought another element of that to Houston. And then pretty early on, once Screw moves into the house in Golf Crest, you get Lil Kiki and the Herschelwood Hardheads. And, you know, in the coming years, you meet Big Mo and he comes in singing, and you got Big Pokey. And so you got sort of a starting five or six of the Screwed Up clique that they're all for the most part from different neighborhoods, different parts of town. They kind of represent different things. They all have different styles, but they're all picking up on the rhythms of DJ Screw and the sort of, you know, the atmosphere that Screw is making available for them to do what it is that they want to do, and the way that Screw sort of quietly egged them on and gave them room to be themselves. So, you know, as the years go on, you know, you've got people who were in Screw's life really early from, you know, from high school and from even before that when he was in Smithfield, his cousin Shorty Mack, you know, the guy that he called his little brother, you know, Al D, who he met in high school and who was a very, very important musical partner for him. You know, these people from his past were still in his present at that point, and they became parts of the Screwed Up Click. And you could almost argue that they were maybe more original Screwed Up Click in the sense that, you know, he the first time that he ever talked about that term was around, you know, those guys in particular, Al D and Shorty Mack and his cousin Act from Smithfield. You know, so again, you got a whole different set of wheels turning that are kind of creating the legacy of DJ Screw and opening up a format, as it were, even though it was a very open format, but a format for all these artists to come in and express themselves.
And let's put it in context. What was the hip hop scene in Houston when DJ Screw is starting to take off in these mixtapes, particularly Rap-A-Lot Records and UGK out of Port Arthur? How did he interact with those forces? What were the neighborhood distinctions and sort of the regional rivalries? And how did they sort of tip the hat, I'm thinking of UGK in particular, to Screw and acknowledge his stylistic innovations as well?
Yeah, well, his relationship with Rap-A-Lot was what I would say was much more kind of from afar than his relationship with UGK. I mean, one of the biggest hip hop groups in the world at that point in the early 1990s was the Ghetto Boys. You know, they were going global. They had, you know, they had songs everywhere. They had songs in movies. They had, you know, they had hits on the charts. So you had that happening from the Rap-A-Lot perspective, and that had been going on really by the time DJ Screw's tapes started really getting out there. You know, the Rap-A-Lot scene had been around for almost a decade. But he didn't really mix it up with many people from Rap-A-Lot. Big Mello, who's a Rap-A-Lot artist, did befriend Screw and did come over to his house, and I don't think was on any tapes, but was it, you know, definitely friends with Screw. And, you know, had they both lived, I'm sure there would have been some collaborations, you know, in the future. But Screw's relationship with UGK was much closer because, you know, it was really DJ Screw who helped to break UGK in Houston by, you know, their earliest release, Tell Me Something Good. You know, when he got a hold of that record as just a 12 inch, you know, in 1992, and Screw was still in the clubs. He was out, you know, DJing in the clubs and playing parties and that sort of thing. And so the UGK record, those early UGK records were ones that he held very close to the heart because it was, you know, they were coming up at the same time. So, you know, his relationship with UGK was close and got closer over the years, especially with Pimp C. He was very close to Pimp C, and so much so. And, you know, and UGK really identified, they were from Port Arthur, but they moved to Houston in the early 90s, and they really identified with what Screw was doing. Even though their sound was different than what he was doing, you know, it was still funky and it was still coming from kind of a country place, you know, and UGK always described their music as, you know, country rap, and, you know, Screw was also from the country. So there was a lot of, you know, there were a lot of things that brought them together. But I think maybe none more so than at the point where, you know, UGK is releasing their album Riding Dirty, you know, 5 years after that Screw broke that original single, they released their album Riding Dirty. And in order to celebrate it, they came over to Screw's house and made a Screw tape and used the beats from their record and freestyled over those beats and changed the lyrics and invited a young rapper named Matt Grace, who was then known as Dat Boy Grace, passed away 5 years ago this week, actually. They brought him over and involved him and really became a more and more a part of what Screw was doing. And artists that were going over Screw's house and getting on the tapes were also on UGK records. And so there was a lot of mixing together on that front. And UGK was very fond of Screw, and Screw was very fond of UGK. And I think really also in a lot of ways, you know, UGK really brought the city together because you got to think about the fact that, like, the north side of Houston and the south side of Houston in the 1990s, really, you know, you didn't really cross those boundaries. It was, you know, sort of a soap opera slash wrestling slash, you know, politics, you know, everybody kind of took sides and nobody really knew why. But you know, I think UGK were really instrumental in getting people up over that. And I think Screw was too, because Screw didn't suffer fools, and he didn't suffer people who didn't get along, you know, in his house. If you two don't get along, you got to get along in here, or you got to both leave. And, you know, so, you know, there were a lot of ways that he connected with UGK. And I think that really, that just continued on the entire time that Screw was alive.
Well, let's hear our next track. This is DJ Screw's Southside Roll On Choppers featuring Big Mo and Fat Pat.
Southside, we be rolling on those choppers. The Southside, we be rolling on those choppers.
Is the rule on top, both the boys out with the beach.
That was DJ Screw's Southside Roll On Choppers featuring Big Mo and Fat Pat. And let's talk about Screw's actual commercially released records with Russell Washington of Big Time Records. And the two of them actually went way back. They had, their parents had dated early on. How did Screw and Russell Washington come together, though, as a business proposition? And how did they make that 3 in the Morning record? And why was Volume 2 released and Volume 1 was never officially released?
Well, Russell Washington contracted Screw to make a mix of all local artists that were on Big Time Records. And that became the album All Screwed Up. And he basically said, you know, he made him a deal here, mix the record and I'll pay you in cash and I'll pay you some points. And, you know, take these local records and make a compilation album out of them. And Screw did that. You know, he got everything he needed on vinyl. And he went into the studio and he made an actual studio record, which is a different thing for him, because most of what he was doing was recording onto a 4-track or an 8-track cassette recorder and then mixing down from cassette to another cassette. So you're losing generations of sound as you go. And so for him to get in the studio and actually record everything onto 2-inch tape and it comes out really sharp and he's got an, okay, well, I didn't quite get that mix right. Okay, well, let's punch it back in, you know, gives him an opportunity to go back in and do that. So that was a really different thing for him. All Screwed Up did well. It did well locally. It did well regionally. You know, Russell Washington with Big Time Records was really pushing to try to get his records out there and make a statement. And, you know, 1995 rolls around and he approaches Screw about doing another record that is really, you know, his own, where he can select the tracks and make his own mix and they'll release it as a studio album. So Screw goes in to the studio and he does this and he comes back to the label. He says, here it is. And, you know, legal folks start looking at it and go, oh my God, you know, this is a nightmare. You've got LL Cool J songs on here. You've got, you know, this stuff that we could never possibly clear. It's, you know, in order to clear the samples, in order to clear the usage of the material, it would cost so much money, either in legal fees or in, you know, the fee that you would have to pay to the songwriter. There was just no way that they could clear it. So what Screw did was to go back in and make a version of this record that he'd been really dreaming up for years, called 3 in the Morning, where he had some Screw tape versions of it that he'd thought up. And there were a few songs that, in particular, that he really wanted to have on that mix that survive on every version of it. And so he had to go back in and make a second version of it. And it took him forever to do it, because the other thing is that he went into the studio and worked on 4 turntables because he had that many ideas for what it was he was going to do and how he wanted to layer things over. So that's how there ended up being 2 mixes. The part 2 was the one that was actually cleared and actually could be released commercially. And part 1 had no clearance on it and couldn't be released commercially. And I think was only just sort of pressed up sort of off to the side. And some of those were released just to local record stores because people wanted them so bad. But they were never, you know, nationally distributed because they just couldn't be cleared. So that was how that happened. Screw and Russell Washington did go back very far. But it was Russell Washington who really approached him and said, I'd like you to mix a record, using, big time artists. And then, came back to him again and said, here's, do a record of your own. So there's a couple different versions of that, but that's what makes Three in the Morning such an interesting, project of Screw's along the way, because he really had, ideas of what he wanted to do with it. And he really wanted to make it right. And, took a lot of opportunities to do so. And dare I say, in the end, he got it right.
Yeah, I would say it's held up. And now, if you could tell us a couple stories about sort of the peak of Screw's local fame, because there's just some amazing anecdotes of, like major labels are interested in trying to meet with them, and, Screw's trying to get to this breakfast meeting in a restaurant, and people are stopping him in the parking lot over and over again. He has to go back to his trunk and sell more tapes. There's even a kid who is dying of cancer, and his dying wish is he wants to make a Screw tape. Tell us a little bit about that and how Screw became, a local legend, and how that even kind of forced him to be on the run, where he had to move locations and set up a real record store because of the unwanted attention from the police, who are noticing the people that are
we're
Screw.
Talking we're talking, like, as far as him being out there and sort of exposed to everything that's going on, we're talking leading up to, about the middle end of 1998. He had the house in Gulf Crest for all those years. People would come to his house to buy the tapes, and they started kind of coming at all hours because people knew where he lived and where he could get the tapes. He had to put up a gate around his porch so that people couldn't just knock on his door. And then he had to start setting hours, like, okay, you can come from 7 to 8 p.m. on these nights. And then he'd change the times a little bit here and there, but for the most part, they stayed pretty consistent. And people would drive over to his neighborhood and line up. They'd park outside of his house and wait. And then when he'd call somebody up, they'd run up there and they'd just, here's some money. Give me some fat Pat or whatever it was. And maybe they had something in particular that they wanted. There was no whiteboard, no dry erase board that listed all the cassettes back then. There was once he opened the shop, there was, but people just kind of had to go with whatever they could get, and he would just run off tapes as quickly as he could. But that was dangerous because he was dealing in cash and, kept money in shoeboxes or wherever, kept it hidden. And, people knew where he lived and would come over his house every day and could look right into his living room whenever he was there at the, at the gate taking money and handing tapes over. So it got to the point where, he felt like, I have to open a shop. I have to get a storefront, because the police kicked his door in a couple times thinking that he was selling drugs. They didn't find anything. They found no drugs. They just found cassettes, smashed a bunch of cassettes, that kind of thing. So he thought, I got to get out of here. I got to go legit. I got to build a storefront. And so he found a space on Cullen Boulevard, right in between South Park and Sunnyside, two South Side neighborhoods in Houston, and opened up his shop in February 1998, and that's when he started charging tax and kind of came in from the cold as far as all that goes, and people had somewhere that they could go more frequently than 7 to 8 p.m. on a Tuesday night or whatever it may have been. Yeah, the fame was definitely catching up to him in the sense that, there were a lot of times that he kind of couldn't go somewhere without being recognized, and people didn't, his face wasn't on any of his albums. So you didn't necessarily know what DJ Screw looked like unless you'd been to his house. But, there were stories that people told me about being in the mall and, talking to him and mentioned his name, and then everybody realizes, oh, that's DJ Screw. And, he gets mobbed. And, so of course he enjoyed the love, and he loved that his music was touching people and reaching people. But you also just never really know who's out there. And, so I think in order for his safety, he finally, moved his operation into an actual storefront, and then got himself a house a little bit outside of the city to kind of get away from it all. So, I mean, I guess you could say his peak is as far as him being sort of out in the public would probably be around 97, 98. But I think that the work that he was doing in his last couple of years was going to lead him to a whole different level of fame and notoriety that would have really extended his reach much more profoundly around the world.
And let's hear our last track. This is Steady Ballin' from DJ Screw.
Time to ball, my limo drive away to side, so there's no time to stall. And I'll be dressed to impress, Vegas still shining. 24 cabs around my neck, filled up with diamonds. Leaving the whole club blinded, that's the way it gotta be. Bros leeching and peeping.
And that was Steady Ballin' from DJ Screw. And so let's talk about his final years. There were two things I think going on that I'd like to cover. One is he's starting to get national attention, wins a national DJ award. He's covered in The Source and other magazines. And at the same time, tragedy is striking right and left. Fat Pat is murdered, and DJ Screw's own health goes south in a big way. Talk about those last couple of years and what Screw managed to get done and what he was on the verge of doing when he passed.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people look at his output in the last couple of years and, you know, maybe say, okay, well, he wasn't making as many cassettes then. He wasn't doing as many tapes. He wasn't doing as many mixes. And that's true. He wasn't releasing as many. But I think he was really making a lot of plans for how he would really approach things in the new millennium and, you know, how he would kind of change up his business and adapt to the times and adapt to what was going on. So, you know, it's hard not to look at it as a dark period, because we also know that there were plenty of drugs around, and that, you know, this was also a point where, you know, he didn't have as many people coming around. So, there was more time, you know, maybe him working alone and, you know, experimenting musically and trying some different things, working hard still like he always did, but, you know, maybe spending more time alone and doing some planning and thinking about what he wanted to do with his future. He wanted to open a studio, you know, he wanted to open a mail order service and make his records available on the internet. You know, I think he probably would have pivoted to CDs at some point. You know, CDs were not that long back then. You know, the original, you know, CDs are, I think, were 70 minutes, something like that. And that's nowhere near as long as a Screw tape. So, you know, he didn't release his stuff on CD because it just wasn't long enough. You know, he wanted all that space to be able to really have his recordings fleshed out. So, you know, there's a tendency for people to think about those last couple of years as like these kind of dark spiraling years. And maybe health-wise, you could think about it that way, because he also, you know, he didn't sleep. He didn't eat well. You know, he didn't exercise. And, you know, he had an enlarged heart. I mean, there's a lot of things. You know, he did smoke PCP. There was some codeine involved, you know. There's a tendency for some people to look at those as dark years, but I kind of think of them as a, you know, those years of transition that was to come that just never got to arrive. Because I think that, you know, I love thinking about what, you know, Screw would have done had he lived, and how he would have picked up on other music from around the world. You know, the way that we're connected now, you know, we weren't connected that way back then. People didn't have mobile phones like that. You couldn't send a text message in Screw's lifetime. That wasn't something that people did. Most people didn't have mobile phones. You know, we didn't have any kind of social media at all, nothing like that. And so, you know, it was just a different era. But I think that he was gearing up to, I think he would have been there. I think he would have, you know, he would have adapted to the changes that were going on. And it would have been really interesting to hear what he would have done with the music from around the world that he would have discovered in the process of being connected the way we are now.
And to wrap up, if you could just quickly talk about his influence on subsequent scenes. First, the scene that came out of Houston, I'm thinking, you know, around 2005 with Mike Jones and Paul Wall and the Swisher House scene. And also Screw's influence in the 2010s on, you know, lo-fi hip-hop and vaporwave and all these kind of things. People all around the world picking up on Screw's music. Just tell us a little bit about how his influence has spread since his passing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't think that, you know, you talk about the kind of Switch House movement of 2004, 2005, Mike Jones, Paul Wall, Slim Thug, Chameleonaire, that whole scene that broke out. That doesn't happen without Screw. You know, that whole scene, that whole Northside scene of Swisher House is influenced by Screw. It doesn't mean that those artists wouldn't have been making records and doing their own thing. I'm sure that, you know, they're all inspired musically and passionate about music. And I think if DJ Screw had never been around, I think they'd all still be making music. They'd just be doing something different. I think all Houston music would sound different if not for DJ Screw. But, you know, in a sense, you know, you had this sort of pressure cooker of what was going on in Houston that was building up over the course of years. And, you know, in the vacuum that was left by Screw's passing, I think you had a lot of people who still wanted to hear that kind of music. They still wanted to hear slowed down music. They wanted to hear slowed down and chopped music, and which is something that Swisher House was doing. And, you know, you have artists that came up that were inspired by Screw and that were out in the streets promoting and doing their own thing and getting better and better at what they did. And, you know, in Houston in particular, you know, you had a major local production and distribution hub in Southwest Wholesale, which collapsed in 2003. And that was where a lot of independent artists in Houston got their records manufactured and distributed. And you know, when that happened, it sort of opened up everything for people to sign with the major labels and, you know, for local deals to have, you know, sort of upstream, you know, possibilities with major labels. So there's really a lot of things happening, you know, over the course of years that built up to that point where when that one song Still Tippin' broke through, which is a song that very much reflects the feeling and the vibe of a Screw tape, even though they're not talking about DJ Screw, but, you know, they're talking about the North Side, but they're still talking about Houston and they're talking about the culture as a whole. But, you know, when that happened, you know, we still, that connectivity that I'm talking about, we still weren't quite there yet. MySpace had just kind of come around. There was no Facebook or anything like that. People, like I said, some people had text messages, but we weren't connected in the way that we are now. So people didn't really know what was going on in Houston until that one song broke through. And then all the cameras sort of swung around and all the lights turned on. They said, okay, Houston, check it out. Who else is there? Well, we got Bun B, we got Chameleonaire, we got K Reno, we got Klondike Cat, we got all these things that have been going on in Houston. Lil Flip, you know, not necessarily people who were part of that giant wave, but were kind of swept up in it because there was so much attention on Houston. And I know this because this is my work started right before this. And so I'm kind of seeing this wave building up as I'm working on these projects, you know, 2004, 2005, goes way back. And you see that all of that happening. So, you know, that and the influence to everybody was DJ Screw, and the influence that people were talking about was DJ Screw. And so that, I think that introduced a lot of people globally to DJ Screw when that happened. And then what do you get? You know, a few years later, you get Drake, you get ASAP Rocky, you know, you get Space Ghost Perp, you get people who are influenced by, you know, maybe were influenced by that Still Tippin' generation and then kind of retroactively learned more about DJ Screw and what was going on in Houston. And then, like you said, you know, years after that, you start getting Witch House and Vaporwave and, you know, the things that you could argue are influenced by DJ Screw. And then, you know, some years later, you got Travis Scott releases Astroworld, which has got a heavy DJ Screw influence. So I think it'll continue to come out in waves. I think, you know, you're going to continue to see, you know, generations of talented artists from Houston coming out. And, you know, it's almost a rite of passage to to mention DJ Screw and to talk about DJ Screw. And I think as a Houston artist, you can't help but be influenced by DJ Screw in some way. So I think you're just going to continue to see that in future years, especially as people become more aware of his story and become more aware of his importance. And the more and more people that you see that are citing his work and talking about his work, I think that'll just cause that much more interest in it. And I think it's, you know, as saying this is the guy who took the time to write a book on it, I think it's infinitely fascinating. And I'm looking forward to the movie that's going to come out and future documentaries. And I just think it's an endlessly interesting, you know, range of study. And I look forward to the future of it. Never gets old.
Absolutely. And Lance, my guest has been Lance Scott Walker. The book is DJ Screw, A Life in Slow Revolution. And yeah, thank you so much for documenting this important Texas musical history. Really love the book. And it's a great guide to, I mean, DJ Screw's work is so, there's so much of it. And it's, you know, it's always been kind of daunting to me to try to go through the different mixtapes, but the book's really been helpful with that. I've really been enjoying, you know, the lessons that you've passed down about DJ Screw. So thanks so much, Lance.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Monday, Nate welcomes Victor Bokris to discuss the Velvet Underground. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.